Welcome to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by ancient language and biblical scholar, Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevahscrossing.com. Lecture 2. What is a Christian liberal arts college?
In the first lecture, I introduced the course to you in a kind of general way. This morning, I want to talk about the subject, what is a Christian liberal arts college? I don't know if this topic really belongs in a course on basic Christianity, but it belongs somewhere very early in your college career, and maybe this is as good a place to trot this out as anywhere else. So whether it belongs here or not, here we go. First of all, what do we mean by liberal arts college? And secondly, what do we mean by the Christian liberal arts college? So let's begin, first of all, to talk about the general concept.
What is a liberal arts college?
I want to frame this in terms of things that we hope will happen to you while you are a student at this kind of institution. I'm going to suggest three of them. There are qualities of life and thinking which we here at Greenville hope that you will come to embody as a result of having studied in the liberal arts college.
Quality of life and thinking, number one, gain a breadth of knowledge.
The liberal arts college hopes to turn out persons who are, in the first place, informed in a variety of fields. Let me say that again. The liberal arts college hopes to develop students who are informed in a variety of fields. Now, you've already discovered, having been through at least two registration lines, that there are graduation requirements at Greenville, and that these fall, some of them at least, in areas where you have no particular interest. You've already discovered that whether you're interested or not, you must take some science, or some history, or some language, or for that matter, some religion. How does it happen that the liberal arts college has graduation requirements which spread out and cover the whole spectrum of knowledge, even though it may be only very superficially? The answer is that this is one of the aims of the liberal arts college, to give you a certain breadth in what you know. Breadth as opposed to the narrow specialization which would be characterized by other kinds of schools. You could be in one of several different kinds of colleges or schools than you are in now. You could have gone into a vocational education program, for example. And depending on the vocation, you wouldn't have had to take the breadth of courses as you take here. If you were in automotive engineering, you don't have to do that much with history, sociology, psychology, and language. So depending on the vocation that you're interested in, the vocational school gives you a narrow preparation for a particular skill that you can perform and earn a living. So you might have been in a secretarial school instead of a liberal arts college, and there you have to learn how to spell and how to type and to do office practice and things like this. But as far as philosophy and psychology and biological science, that's not important to being a good secretary. And often, at least, in the secretarial school, you don't have to do that either. You might be in a technical school of some sort, not the automotive type, but engineering of various sorts, or perhaps even dentistry, electrical engineering, or mechanical engineering. You can enroll as soon as you're out of high school in technical programs. There, the courses that we call the humanities are not really important. What are important are the technical subjects of math and science. You might even be in a Bible school. The Bible School is a kind of specialized program. It's certainly important for persons who want the specialized programs, but those of you who transfer in from a Bible school, most of you have not done that, but we have a lot of them, will bring in 2 or 3 years of study, almost all of which will be related to the Bible. There won't be any English or history or language or philosophy or science. Why not? Because you go to a Bible school to get a specialized preparation for a particular branch of Christian service that you're interested in, and you get the specialty and nothing else. Now, the liberal arts college poses a breadth in contrast to this rather narrow specialization, which is part of many other kinds of institutions. And we do so because we think that you will be a better person, a more intelligent person, and a happier person if you know a little bit about a number of subjects. The breadth that a liberal arts education offers you will make life more interesting and more whole. William Lyon Phelps, who lived from 1865 to 1943, who was a professor of English at Yale until his death, wrote in his autobiography that you could take a class of first-rate engineering students taught by the most extraordinary professor imagined, and they would learn a lot of engineering, but they would not learn very much about life. In contrast to this, you'll pardon Phelps, he takes as his example a course in Greek literature, and he says, "You may not learn how to parse all the verbs perfectly, but you can't study Greek literature very long without learning something about how to live." This is what we think about the liberal arts college, that the breadth of the courses will help you learn how to live in a way that the specialized curriculum of the vocational school will not do. One student whom I had a number of years ago put it this way. It's kind of awkwardly put, but he said, "You know, the longer I live, there's a broader way of looking at things." And that's so. We hope here that you will be broadened out to see a lot of things that you would not see otherwise. General Electric made a study of nearly 14,000 college graduate employees of their company, asking, "Are you satisfied with your own college experience now that you're out in the working world?" These are mostly persons employed in the engineering aspects of GE. Of special interest to us is the way the non-engineering grads responded. That is, here are people engaged in the work of engineering, but who did not go to an engineering school. Now, of those persons, 3 out of 4 said they would take the same courses of study over again. That is, they would go to a place like Greenville College, a liberal arts institution, rather than attend a technical engineering program. The greatest degree of dissatisfaction was found among those who had attended teachers' colleges and received a degree in education. They believed a broader education would have been of more general and lasting value. And the person who conducted the study said this, "The purpose of undergraduate education is not the acquisition of specialized information and operational techniques. Rather, the power to think and analyze a wide range of problems successfully is the true goal of a college education." We need the breadth that liberal education can give us, so that we can become liberated from provincial and narrow viewpoints, which really are inhibiting. We need, for example, an awareness of what has happened in other times and places in history, so we know how properly to evaluate what is happening to us in our own time. This is one of the things which is bad, it seems to me, about the Red Guard, because they are cutting off present Chinese society from all of which has gone before. And I do not see how a society can really survive unless it has some perspective on itself. But it's the study of history that gives you perspective on the present. We need to know. We need to have perspective on the moral and political ideas which are part of our society. Several years ago in Missouri, an interesting case came before the state Supreme Court. It had to do with a medical doctor named Mishner, a man of fine medical qualifications, who was licensed to practice both in Pennsylvania and in California, and was a member of the University of Pennsylvania Medical School faculty. Dr. Mishner became a visiting professor for a year or two at Washington University in St. Louis. While he was in St. Louis, he applied to practice medicine in Missouri. Now, in Missouri, the agency that screens applications of this sort is called the State Board for the Registration of the Healing Arts. They looked over Dr. Mishner's credentials, and they turned him down. The reason they turned him down were these. When Mishner was in the Army during the Second World War, he was a pacifist. And even though he had been drafted and went in, he wasn't a conscientious objector. Still, he was opposed to the war effort. On one occasion, he went AWOL and then turned himself in. The reason he did this was to protest against the war effort. It does sound completely unacceptable in the present situation, but it was different during the Second World War. It turned out he never really was court-martialed for it. I don't know why, but he expected to be, because he was ready to take the rap. The board said to him, "You believe in breaking laws if you don't like them, is that right?" "Well," he said, "under certain circumstances, if the law violates my conscience, I would have to break the law." This is done so often today. It's called civil disobedience. You disobey the law if you don't like it. This is what essayist Henry David Thoreau, who lived from 1817 to 1862, is famous for. And when I mention the name Thoreau, you see the concept of civil disobedience goes a long way back in American history and American thought, and it's a reputable idea. What's disreputable about it is that people break the law and expect not to have to pay the penalty. But neither Thoreau nor Dr. Mishner were in this situation. Well, the State Board for the Registration of the Healing Arts felt there was something subversive about this, and they said, "We can't register you. We don't know when you'd go around breaking laws you didn't like." And the way the thing came out isn't particularly important. I've already got to the part that I was making the point for. But the way it came out was that Mishner said, "You are turning me down because you don't like my ideas, not because I'm not qualified as a physician." And that was right. And it was wrong. And he kept at this for several years, and finally the St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper took up the crusade, and the result was that Mishner was finally approved by the state board. I think some rearrangement in the matter of licensing took place. Dr. William Henry Danfort, who lived from 1926 to 1995 of the Washington University Medical School, said, after all this was over, "The medical profession is the most narrowly educated profession in America." Now, why did he say that? Because there was a group of medical men who had no real concept that civil disobedience and the right of the individual conscience are respectable and reputable, even in America. They had no feeling, really, for moral ideas and their value. Now, if we steer you here at the Liberal Arts College into a variety of courses, it is in part because we hope you will become a person with breadth who sees things and gets perspective on the present because of that breadth.
Quality of life and thinking number 2. Value ideas for their own sake.
Secondly, we hope to turn out students who are interested in ideas for their own sake. Now, many of us find it very hard not to evaluate what we do in terms of how it benefits us. And benefit usually means financial benefit. We have a very utilitarian turn of mind. We want to know what good it will do us. And if it won't do us some good, especially make us a buck, then we're not really interested in doing it. There is here a kind of narrow pragmatism in the American character, which the liberal arts college hopes to work against and to counteract. William Temple, who lived from 1881 to 1944, he was the late Archbishop of Canterbury, was involved at one time in his career in public education in Great Britain. Of course, the British educational system is very different from our own. He was involved in a situation that is quoted in his biography. One morning, a little boy brought to school a note to the teacher, who was Temple. Scrawled on a grocery bag, the note said, "Don't teach my boy poetry. He's going to be a grocer." William Temple said that when that happened, he tried to get across to the class, and then later on he tried to get it across to the parents, the idea that there was some treasures of learning which were of no conceivable importance in the struggle for material gain, but which still had a great deal of importance to the way people think and live. Now, the liberal arts college hopes to get you interested in ideas for their own sake. Whether the idea will help you make more money or not, you should become a sort of person who is interested in ideas for their own sake. You will have to work very hard to keep this ideal before you. It is the difference between getting an education and getting a degree. Some of you will go through Greenville College, get a degree, and come out an educated person. It is the difference between taking a course to get it out of the way and taking a course to learn something. It is the difference between studying to meet requirements and studying to learn. It is the difference between reading collateral to get the pages done and reading collateral to see what the book is all about. A vast difference, and I admit that there are some things about the way American education is structured that makes it very hard for you to think in these terms. I hope that you will work at it. It is my own ideal, always to try to set things up so that the student who cares about learning things and does has at least equal advantage with a student who only does the requirements as busy work without caring what the thing is really about. A number of years ago, I taught a summer school course on the Epistles of St. Paul. In my class were two ladies who were public school teachers. They were older ladies, older than anybody present here today. One of them would retire from public school teaching within 5 years, and the other one would have retired within 3 years. They both now have long since retired. This was really a marvelous experience. Here are these ladies, almost on the verge of retirement, pursuing their thirst for learning and knowledge right down to the very end of their professional career. And of all things useless to them in public education, they are enrolled in a class of Paul's epistles. What a wonderful illustration of caring about ideas. Alas, I wish it had been so. As it turned out, the course in Paul's epistles was the last 3-hour requirement they had to take before getting their degree. And they cared about the degree because if they got their degree in time, their retirement pay would be $1,000 a year more than if they didn't. I don't begrudge those dear ladies their $1,000 a year. But I have to say, this is not education. Something is wrong here. And I guess it's probably wrong with the American system as a whole. But when it comes to stating the ideals anyway, the liberal arts college doesn't care so much about the degree. It does care what you know. A friend of mine told me something when he was a senior in seminary. That means his 3rd year after college. He was a very, very bright student. He made A's here at Greenville and A's all through seminary. He had planned to go to the mission field, and something happened, and he went to graduate school instead. He said that in his 3rd year of seminary, when he began to think about going to graduate school, he had revolutionized his approach to study. Why? because he began to see that in graduate school, they didn't care how many courses you had had, they cared about what you knew. That's the difference. People who care about ideas for their own sake. Several years ago, when I was a pastor of a church in an eastern state, one of the members in that particular parish had a son. He was a great big, good-hearted, lovable Swede. His mother was so glad he got through high school, she didn't even breathe a word about going to college. And he didn't go. He got himself a job working as a welder, and he became a good welder. He acquired the skill necessary. He worked his way up a little bit in the shop that he was in. All that happened several years ago. Summer before last, I was back in that particular community, and I met this guy again, and we got together and we had some conversation. I discovered that something had happened to this guy since I knew him before. I still don't know exactly how it happened, but he had experienced a kind of intellectual awakening. For once, he didn't care about talking about the low-level things. He was very excited about, and he wanted to talk about the kind of work that I was doing, and this sort of thing. He told me an interesting story or two about how he was now getting along with the guys in the shop. It turns out that one day they said to him, "Carlson, we don't hear you talking much anymore." Well, he explained to me why he wasn't talking much anymore. It seems that among the things that he had done was to subscribe to the Wall Street Journal. He wasn't speculating in stocks or anything. He just wanted to read. And in the Wall Street Journal, he saw a picture printed of one of those half-dollar sandwich coins. The picture showed that this particular sandwich coin had come apart into pieces. The picture was there, and there was a caption, but there was no article. He had read the caption and looked at the picture and thought that it was very interesting. When he got to the shop the next day, he told the boys about this, and they hooted at him. They said, "What do you do? Just read stuff like that so you can tell it when you get here?" So he quit talking. And he now sees that there's a difference between him and those guys because he cares about things they don't care about. Let me give another example. It's kind of the other end of things. A high school student in Greenville High School, and you may be able to identify this guy, it doesn't really matter, got to go on tour with the Greenville College Band. He was very scared when he got to go on this tour, but he came back very excited, and he said to me, "College students are a lot different than I thought they'd be. They are a lot different than high school students. College students will listen to you when you talk. They will take you seriously. High school students, they're afraid to think. They don't want to think about ideas, but college students will listen when you talk." I hope he's right on that. At least I hope he's right about the college students he met. He told me that once he was in a class out at the high school, and they were listening to a report from somebody on some esoteric subject like Michelangelo or something like that. So he asked a question. "What were the artist guilds like in the time of Michelangelo?" And the class all hooted at him. And he said, "Ah, come on, don't be so stuffy." Okay, this illustrated to him that there are people who don't care about the ideas, and there are people who do care. Now we're working on the other end of things. We hope that you will learn to think about important things, not because it will make money for you, but because this is the kind of person you want to be.
Quality of life and thinking number 3, develop critical thinking.
All right, third, we hope to turn out persons who are able to evaluate. Can you tell a good argument from a bad one? Can you tell when a man hasn't given you enough evidence to support what he says? Can you detect false reasoning from true reasoning? Do you have serious opinions about important things? Can you tell when something is relevant and when it isn't? Can you tell the difference between a leading idea and supporting data? Now, all of this becomes very, very important, not just in religion, but in politics and in almost anything that you do. The American people are expected to form judgments on things that are of very great importance in world affairs and in domestic policy. Do they know? Can the average American tell when a politician is feeding him a lot of guff and when he is giving good, cogent arguments? A year or so ago, when Ronald Reagan was running for governor of California and was already coming into national attention, one of the commentators noted the techniques that Reagan was using to get himself elected. I don't know if this is true or not, but this is what the commentator said with tongue in cheek. Reagan is the ideal candidate. He avoids the issues. He isn't going to make the mistake Barry Goldwater made. Is that the kind of people we are, where a man who avoids the issues can get himself elected? Whether it's true of Reagan or not is beside the point. The illustration serves. The liberal arts college hopes to turn out people who have developed a critical capacity for thinking, for evaluating ideas and what they read. Several years ago, I had an opportunity to spend some time talking to a couple of students from a technical university, two or three states away from here. It was just kind of by accident that I had a chance to talk to them, but I did. I was talking to them about religious things, among other things. I had a terrible time talking to those guys. They were so wrapped up in the metrical dimension of things. They could do long equations in their head, and they could measure things and weigh things. They spent their whole livelong day working in this particular dimension of things. And when I tried to deal with them in terms of ideas, it seemed to me they were helpless. I felt so sorry for them. I felt so frustrated. How do you talk to people who don't have any facility with ideas, who don't know how to evaluate an argument, who aren't accustomed to deduction and making conclusions of this sort? One of those guys wrote me a letter. It wasn't any great shakes of a letter. It wasn't 10 pages long, single-spaced typed. It was about 5.5 pages scrawled. He said it took him all morning. I don't know why it would have taken him all morning. Maybe it takes you all morning, too. I don't know. Maybe he thought a lot in between times. But I had the feeling that here was a guy who doesn't know what to do with an idea. He doesn't know how to talk, except in quantitative terms. All right, that may not have happened to you, but I hope that you can still develop skills in evaluation. I think you'll find that a lot of things that I ask you to do in this course are set up to accomplish these three aims: to broaden you and to make you interested in ideas, and to develop a critical capacity as far as ideas are concerned. At the same time, if it wasn't for men and women of their technical skills and interests, skyscrapers would never stand and airplanes would never fly. Nonetheless, I defend the Liberal Arts College and defined it in terms of what we hope will happen. Primarily, what we hope will happen to the life of the mind. The things that you know something about, the things you're aware of, that's a certain breadth, an interest in ideas for their own sake, not just because you have to perform an assignment. I think there's quite a lot of contempt for the intellectual in American life, and I'm not quite sure why. Henry Steele Commager, who lived from 1902 to 1998, in his book, The American Mind, calls attention to this. He points out that in America and America alone, he's contrasting American with the European continent, in America and America alone, the professor who is invariably long-haired and absent-minded is an object of humor. And Commager wants to know why we should make jokes at the expense of the professor. It's not done, he says, in the continent. There, the professor is a respected person. He may be long-haired and absent-minded, but they don't make jokes about him. And one wonders if there's a little bit of suspicion in the American character for intellectual achievement. You look, for example, at the success Adlai Stevenson II had. He lived from 1900 to 1965. Or did not have, depending on how you look at him. Stevenson ran for president. What defeated him? Well, I don't know. But he got the label egghead, for one thing. Egghead is a pejorative name. It's a down-labeling. It's an uncomplimentary way of referring to an intellectual. Why should an intellectual be referred to in uncomplimentary ways? When I was a student at Princeton, it was during the time of the President Dwight Eisenhower and Stevenson campaign, and one of the debating clubs on the university campus set up a topic of debate like this. Resolved, what this country needs is less ham and more eggheads. Now you can figure that one out. And of course, the university community generally appreciates intellectual achievements. Maybe the average American doesn't. I'm just trying to say we need to get rid of this prejudice against knowing something. We need to rid our minds of the idea that if we know something that we can't use, we're an egghead, and therefore somehow not very bright after all. We want you to be interested in ideas for their own sake, able to evaluate arguments and the things that you read.
What is a Christian liberal arts college?
All right, now, let me turn to the second half of things. What do we mean by a Christian liberal arts college? Well, to start with, the educational aims here in the first part of the development are presupposed. That is to say, I don't see any justification for a Christian college if it isn't first a good school. I don't think we should take an inferior educational procedure, sanctify it up by associating it with the church, and to expect people to think they've been dealt with fairly. The Christian liberal arts college must, first of all, be doing a good job of being a college, at least. It has to know what a good college is and be trying to be so. Thus the purpose of a liberal arts education institution. I'm well enough aware that we've got loopholes in what we're trying to do here. I sometimes think there are loopholes in our understanding of our job. But that may not be so. There certainly are loopholes in what we are actually doing. So to start with, a Christian liberal arts college has to be a good college or there is no point in going on. I'm not interested in an institution only because it's religious. It's got to be more than that. Now, let me take a negative approach and say a couple things about what it's not.
Number one, not an escape.
A Christian liberal arts college is not primarily a retreat from the world. You may think you've heard enough about this lately. Just let me hit it and I'll go on by. We do sometimes get the idea that the reason a place like Greenville exists is so that we may be sheltered from the swirling currents of the world of unbelief. And I admit that there is some sense in which this is so. I don't think it's nearly as much as some people think, however. I agree that any time you have a chance to assume responsibility, you're in real life. And when it comes to just plain scumminess, if that's what makes real life, as I've lived in the dormitory and I know something about it, I think you are in touch with real life, even here on campus. Though I grant that the mood and the spirit and the tone of things is different than it would be on a state campus. So the college may function in some way to create an atmosphere which is not quite as strident and as hostile as the world of unbelief may be. But that's not the primary reason for the existence of the Christian college. That's a byproduct. If it's the product of the byproduct, that's not the primary reason.
Number two, not a church.
The Christian Liberal Arts College is not primarily a church. Now, the functions of the church are evangelism and Christian nurture, and we do perform those functions here. Our chapels, our church services, our Bible studies are all working at this general aim. Once again, I think these are a byproduct. The Christian college does not exist to do the work of the church. The church exists through the work of the church on its own. And if the church isn't doing the work of the church, then it ought to be reformed, rather than starting some subsidiary institution to take over its functions. The college doesn't exist to replace the church. Let the church do its own work. And if we perform some of the functions of the church here, like evangelism and Christian nurture, fine. But that's not primarily why the school is here. The school doesn't exist to get people saved. It may do this, but it exists for something far more than that.
Number 3, specific aims.
All right, let's now consider the specific aims of the Christian Liberal Arts College. A, learning around Jesus Christ. The Christian Liberal Arts College is an institution where the educational process takes seriously the truths of biblical revelation. Again, the educational process implied by the term liberal arts is carried out in an environment that takes seriously the truths of biblical revelation. We have this slogan around Greenville, education in a distinctive Christian environment. Would we have a Christian college if we, say, transported from the state campus to our own campus the educational program that exists there? That is, what if we transferred it as it is from there to here, and then sanctified it by the addition of required chapel and Vespers attendance, add to it late hour and last minute penalties, and drinking regulations in the dormitory, and so forth? Would we have a Christian college if we took the program at State and added on the distinctive religious features of the Greenville program? No, of course not. We wouldn't. We would have what is essentially a naturalistic educational approach to things with religious requirements added on. It's not the adding on of a distinctive environment which makes the Christian college. It is that somehow everything which is done is touched by the religious commitments of that particular institution. Everything which is done has got somehow to be a little different because it's done by people who are looking at life a little differently than it may be looked at elsewhere. And this is something I talked about in lecture number 1, the different concepts of reality. B, materialism versus theism. The Christian Liberal Arts College explores the difference between the naturalistic worldview and the theistic worldview. One view is the naturalistic concept that what is real is limited to the processes of nature, which can be observed and measured by science. The other view is what I call the theistic outlook on life. Besides nature, there is God, who is seeking to realize or achieve good in the world. Again, besides nature, there is God, a divine mind, to put it philosophically. There is God who is seeking to achieve good in the world. If your presuppositions fall within the naturalistic approach, then nothing is real which cannot be measured by the methods of science. If your approach to life is theistic, then there are some realities which lie beyond scientific measurement, beyond empiricism. And it makes a big difference which outlook on life you take. Now, such differences in a worldview may not make much difference when doing hard science. I think in physics, it's hard to see how a difference in worldview would change your work substantially, although you may be able to find some ways in which the Christian biologist looks at things different from the naturalistic biologist. Though I don't think it's true that when you get into the laboratory here at Greenville, that you have Christian frogs and Christian worms which you dissect. So in the hard sciences, I don't think there's any real difference in what you do or how you do it. But when you move over into the realm of the humanities, where we are beginning to deal with ideas, then the kind of approach to life which you take makes a very great deal of difference. When you get into the realm of psychology and sociology, the worldview of the teacher really determines a great deal of the content, because psychology and sociology are full of judgments on the nature of man. And if you think that man is just an animal with no dimension beyond himself at all, that is, no dimension beyond the scientifically verifiable, then you will pose one solution to the problems of man and society. If you think that man has dimensions which cannot be measured by science, then you will pose another solution to the same problems of man and society. And so, when we talk about the Christian Liberal Arts College, we are thinking that somehow, in every respect of the college's work, the theistic way of looking at reality is taken seriously, and the biblical outlook on life is taken seriously. This doesn't mean you're protected from knowing how the naturalist thinks. Mostly, you're not protected from that. You bring it with you from high school, for one thing. And for another thing, on the whole, here I think you're presented with the other points of view. It does mean that there's a serious effort made in all that the college does to see what life means if Jesus Christ is the center. And so, the Christian Liberal Arts College is a whole educational process somehow touched by commitment to the things which seem most fundamentally real. Let me try one more way to get at this here. If the naturalist is right, then we're foolish to pretend that he's not. If we think the naturalist is wrong, then it would be equally stupid for us to teach as though he was right. So why shouldn't we teach in line with what we think is most truly real? Everybody does this. They do it at a state campus. The difference often is that they don't tell you what they are doing, and we do try to tell you what we're doing here. But it's no use pretending that you can teach as though naturalism is true when you don't believe it. You can't, and it would be stupid if you could. So, I'm talking now about the Christian Liberal Arts College in terms of something which happens to the whole program, and not just the add-ons, the superficial requirements. C. The wholeness of Christian education. The Christian Liberal Arts College integrates the many disciplines of life and learning as a unified whole under the lordship of Jesus Christ. Now, I've tried to give you some general angles on what I think is a Christian liberal arts college by discussing its educational aims, by telling what it clearly is not, and how it is Christ-centered. But I'm afraid that is hard to get a hold of. It's hard to get a hold of because we are not used to thinking about learning as a whole. We're used to thinking about doing this specific assignment. We don't even think about the course as a whole, not to mention education as a whole, and we're not used to thinking about our courses and subject matter as having anything to do with any particular point of view, worldview, or philosophy of life. What I'm trying to say is that one of the reasons for having a Christian liberal arts college is so that we can see all of life and all of learning as a unified whole from the standpoint of the incarnation of Jesus Christ. A Christian liberal arts college is not just trying to get people converted or off the streets at 11 p.m. It is Christian insofar as the whole educational program takes seriously the truths of biblical revelation. I never thought about this much until after 3 or 4 years ago. I came across a statement about John F. Kennedy by a Roman Catholic educator who also happens to be a Catholic priest. He's talking about parochial Catholic schools, but I was thinking of his comment in the context of Greenville College, which also is a parochial school. His conclusion is that the parochial school does not really prepare people to take their place in American life as a whole. Here's exactly what this priest and educator said. I think John F. Kennedy would not have become president had he received his formal education in Catholic schools, precisely because Catholic schools are what they are. Catholic schools do not train men and women to be leaders in our society. They tend to separate, to divorce men and women from our society. Studies have shown that Catholic schools produce more loyal Catholics, but not necessarily leaders in the society. I can readily believe that the product of Catholic schools are better practicing Catholics, but this does not seem to me to be the ultimate norm by which we should judge our church schools. The degree to which they carry their religion into the world does seem closer to the norm, and this is precisely where we fail. By segregating Catholic youngsters from the rest of the world throughout the long years of their formal education, we are severely restricting the possibility of their effective engagement in that world as Christian adults. Those are the words of Reverend Father J. Joyce, editor of the Oklahoma Courier, official newspaper of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Oklahoma City, Tulsa. Now that's a very astonishing thing for a Roman Catholic educator and priest to say. Kennedy would not have been elected president if he had gone to a parochial school. And the test by which we ought to judge our school system is the extent to which they prepare young people to carry their faith into the world. I like that phrase very much, and I've kind of borrowed it from this particular educator. One of the things we hope the Christian Liberal Arts College does is to help you carry your faith into the world, help you take your place as a meaningful and useful member of society, without giving up your faith, but rather because you know on what grounds your faith rests, with some ability to carry your faith into the world of unbelief. So, that may tie together just a little bit what I'm trying to get across about the Christian Liberal Arts College. And that's all for this morning.
Thank you for listening to the Basic Christianity Podcast, a college lecture series by Dr. Stanley D. Walters, presented by his student, Dr. Stanley D. Williams. The 33 lectures are found in Dr. Walters' fully illustrated book, Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons, available at ninevascrossing.com. Thank you for listening.